I'm Marty Moscoane. Welcome to Radio Times. When 18-year-old Chris Wilson was sentenced to life in prison without parole, his grandfather told him, "Don't waste your life. You're young. You've got time." Wilson was sentenced after being found guilty of murder and decided, after the shock of imagining his life behind bars, to create a master plan of long and short-term goals. Earn a college degree, learn Spanish, improve his interview skills, start a business, remain a lifelong learner. He eventually convinced a judge to give him a second chance. She reduced his sentence to 24 years, and since his release, he started several businesses in Baltimore where he lives. But reentry wasn't easy, starting his life all over again, learning from his mistakes, and using his skills as an entrepreneur. Chris Wilson writes about all of this and his childhood that was marked by violence in his new book called The Master Plan, My Journey from Life in Prison to a Life of Purpose, co-written with Brett Witter, and joins us on Radio Times. Chris Wilson, nice to have you with us
on
the show.
Thanks for me.
You're very welcome, and thanks for writing this book. Let me begin with your life, and you have told this story multiple times. You have not told it on Radio Times. So help us understand about the neighborhood that you grew up in, and this was around Washington, D.C.
Sure. Well, I grew up in Washington, D.C., around the late 80s, early 90s, and this was around the time when the crack epidemic was sweeping through communities all throughout America, and it was a lot of gun violence in the neighborhood. I remember speeding cars, tires squealing, all kinds of stuff that I witnessed, and it was just very difficult. My family was pretty loving at the time, but when we would go outside, we would see a lot of things.
In fact, you write about the fact that you lost friends, family, who were people that were shot at and murdered.
Yeah, every couple of months, it was like, you know, Kevin's gone, little Anthony got killed, and, you know, a couple of them died in front of me. And, you know, I remember vividly, you know, trying to, you know, keep them from going into shock by telling them jokes and doing stuff, and, like, they would pass away, and it just was tough. I still think about this.
There was also violence in your home, although you describe early on your parents did divorce, but your mom was a nurse. I mean,
yes.
It seemed like your both your parents were able to support the family, but then she fell in love with this really vicious, sadistic police officer.
Yeah, it was horrible. I mean, before that, you know, I really cherished my relationship with my mom. You know, I was a diehard mama's boy, always around
You're
her.
Right, like, that you were a mama's boy, yeah.
Like, anywhere she went, I was there. You know, my siblings would be like, "Why don't you leave her alone? Why are you always around your mom?" But, you know, it just changed when she met that police officer.
And he was, I mean, he was he battered her.
Yeah.
Brutally.
Yeah. I mean, if you think about it, he reminds me of, like, the role Denzel Washington played in the movie Training Day.
Oh, sure.
Just like, I mean, he was setting people up out in the streets. He was doing all kinds of stuff, but, like, still had some kind of charm to him. And he had, like, this control over my mom.
You said he hated you, or it felt like he hated you.
Yeah, he definitely hated me.
And he beat you as well.
Yeah, he put guns to my head, all kinds of stuff. It was tough. And I would tell my mom about it at first, and, like, she wouldn't believe it. Mm-hmm. Or he just had, like, this power over her.
Well, you do describe one particular incident where, I mean, it felt as if he practically beat her to death.
Yeah.
And you were there.
Yeah, it was painful. And my mom's friend was there as well. And it was something that really changed me because, you know, my love for my mom, and, like, he knocked me unconscious. When I woke up, I couldn't help her. Right. And I think I knew where a gun was in the house, and I write about this. I wanted to go get it, but it just wasn't in me.
Yeah, to get the gun even the possibility of using a gun.
Yeah, I wasn't, like, I didn't have the heart to, like, hurt anyone at that time.
And it sounds like she fell apart.
Yeah, I never got my mom back after that. And I write about this strange, I understand it now that I'm older, but, like, when that happened to her, it was so traumatic that she couldn't work again. She fell into a depression. And from her injuries, she was overprescribed, like, pain pills, and she got addicted to them. And he just turned on me, and I write about it. And so
you do. You also write about being in school. And let me just quote something that you – actually, something that you said about being in school, that I was never a good student, too much anxiety. Even as a first grader, I stayed awake most nights worrying about the yelling, the gunshots, the car tires squealing away. More than any other sound from my youth, that's what I remember, car tires squealing away.
I still flinch every now and then when I hear
car. When you hear that?
Yeah, I just, like.
What did that mean, though, to hear that?
It means, like, you know, it was usually, like, shooting and then cars squealing or cars squealing and then shooting. So I just associate the sound with like the memories that I remember growing up.
You also describe, I mean, in a sense, I mean, trying to imagine being a first grader, a second grader, a third grader, living with in a dangerous neighborhood and living with domestic violence at home.
Right.
About the kind of PTSD you
must
have
exactly.
had.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and I still deal with it. I go to therapy once a week, and it just helps me like just get through and just cope with like my experiences.
Does it feel like you grew up in a combat zone?
Definitely. I grew up in a combat zone.
In fact, you had a prison therapist say to you, you know, you have to deal with this, that you, this is how you grew up and it affected you.
Yeah, it was, you know, especially in prison, therapy was something. And initially for like the first 2 years, I wouldn't even talk about it because I felt like no one would understand like the stuff that I saw or like what it felt like to see all these things. And then at some point, you know, maybe 2 years into therapy, I just decided to talk about it. And then other people in my group started talking about it. And I realized like we all from these communities have been through the same stuff.
Both violence in the street and violence at home.
Absolutely.
Let me ask you a little bit more about growing up. And I mean, it sounds like, as you said, you were a smart kid.
I was a reader. I was smart. But
and
I
you loved
read
the
really
library
well.
And all of that.
I would get in trouble all the time for going to the library.
Was there a library in the school or a library in the neighborhood?
We had like a smaller library in the school, but it was a big library a few blocks away from the house. But it was a big four-lane street that we wasn't allowed to cross because it was dangerous. But they had these programs in the library where librarians would read to us. And like they would take like complicated or history books and they had like children's versions. And they would read. And I was like a kid. I wasn't in sports. So I had like this imagination. And when they would read these stories, I would imagine like that, you know, I'm in Egypt or I'm on some ship through like traveling through the Pacific. And it was just my way to escape.
Did you get good grades? And sometimes there's a disconnect between being a smart young person and getting the grades that go along with that.
I barely got by. I was just able to read really well. Mm-hmm. But I didn't really get good grades. Yeah. I was like average, below average. I get D's and C's or whatever. So
you describe, I mean, several incidents, but and you mentioned the fact that when this man was beating up your mom, you knew there was a gun in the house.
Right.
When and why did you start carrying a gun?
At a certain point, once my brother was shot in front of the house, my cousin was shot and killed, and then a few of my friends were being killed, and then we're watching the news every day. And this was around the time when D.C., Washington, D.C. was like the murder capital of America. And it's like stuff would happen in the neighborhood, and you know, people call the police, and they wouldn't show up. Or maybe they would come like 45 minutes later. And so I felt like I don't want to die, so I'm going to carry this gun for protection. And it's like a defense mechanism. I kind of like want people in the neighborhood to know I have it so they won't bother me.
Right.
But I didn't have a gun, and I wasn't like – I didn't have it to go look to hurt someone.
You even describe an incident where you were kidnapped. Is that too strong a word? But you were taken off the street.
Yeah.
You were kidnapped.
In front of my house.
And it sounded like you came within an inch of being killed.
Right.
And when you came home to tell your family, they kind of laughed at you.
Yeah, they didn't. They laughed at me. They didn't kind of laugh at me.
They laughed at you.
And that was a terrifying moment to me, something that I also think about today. And that changed me in a sense. After my mom being attacked and after me being kidnapped, it kind of changed me. And it was like, I can't hesitate. How many chances am I going to get? And I was like, so like the next time I feel threatened or something, like either I'm going to die or I'm going to have to use this gun.
You describe yourself becoming hard.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's just sort of walling off all those
right.
emotions about being afraid or vulnerable or,
right.
or worried about something.
Yeah.
So if we were to see you at the age of, 15, 16?
Yeah.
What did you look like?
I was desensitized to the violence. I was like very quiet, very, very angry.
Very, very
15,
angry.
Yeah.
Angry at the world?
Yeah, everyone. Yeah, I felt like, you know, all the stuff that we've been through, especially like with my mom, I hated my life and I didn't understand like why things were getting so bad because we still had the nice house at the time when I was 15. Mm-hmm. But my mom was just messed up and we were losing stuff. There were bills on the door, eviction notices. And then my friends in the neighborhood, they had families and they were going on trips and doing Thanksgiving and we didn't have anything. And I just didn't understand why I wasn't allowed to be a child.
Mm. What did you think your life was going to be? Or did you think you had a future?
I thought I was going to die.
You did?
Yeah, it's videotape. that like my cousin had took back then, and we were all sitting around and we were like drinking, and I was like, I'd be lucky if I make it to 21.
Wow. And you think other people your age at that time or even today feel that way?
I think so, yeah.
I mean, especially in that kind of environment?
Yeah. I mean, what else do you have to hope for when you can't see anything or you don't know anyone who's in your life who's been successful, who's made it out? And that's one of the reasons why I wanted to, like, tell my story.
Sure.
Because I was able to make it out.
Well, it's such an important story. How hard was it to get a gun? And you were a teenager.
Yeah, guns are everywhere. Everybody had guns, yeah. It's still like that, unfortunately.
Yeah. I mean, you knew where to go, and it was easy, and a couple $100 or something like that, and you owned a gun.
$200, yeah.
Describe the incident that landed you in prison.
So it was one of these nights I was walking to the store, and it was late, and some men I noticed were following me. And for a couple of blocks, I knew, like, that they were following me. I knew they wasn't from my neighborhood. So I decided to walk to an area where it was, like, a lot of light, and there was stores and, like, gas station and stuff. And they surrounded me. And they started threatening me, and they said, we know where you stay at, we know where you live at, your family, don't think that you're safe. And then one of the guys was trying to corner me and get behind me. And then, you know, I pulled my gun, and I ended up taking a person's life.
Right. And just, was it just that, without thinking?
Yeah, it was.
That you pulled the trigger?
Yeah, it was something that was, like, building up all the things that happened before that. And I was like, I can't hesitate. And it was just, like, I was a child. I was 17. These were men. They were in their 30s. And I just, you know, I just overreacted. And I did it. And it's like, it's, you know, it took me a long time to realize, like, what I had done.
Mm-hmm. And once you pulled the trigger, what happened next? I mean, what is the next thought?
I just ran in the other direction. And I just remember just being like, you know, just shot in shock.
Right. Thinking you'd never do this.
And I didn't even know, I pulled the trigger and they ran a different direction. I ran another direction. And I was like, how did I miss?
Thinking, like, that you had missed.
Yeah.
But you didn't.
I didn't miss.
Right.
Yeah.
And who was the man you killed?
I can't mention him.
Right.
Out of respect of his family.
Right.
Like, I won't mention him.
We're almost having a break here, but you do say that in your trial, no one showed up for him. I mean, he was...
Yeah.
No one... There was no witnesses that came out. Nothing. I mean,
right.
It was basically him and you.
Yeah. I tried to reach out to the family, like, many times when I was in prison as, mm-hmm. like, you know, like a process of, like, redemption and, you know, feeling remorse. But I just couldn't find anyone.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking with Chris Wilson. And he's got a new book. It's called The Master Plan, and it's subtitled My Journey from Life in Prison to a Life of Purpose. And it's written with Brett Witter. He lives in Baltimore. He obviously is out of prison. He does work on criminal justice. He's also an entrepreneur. You can join us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Many ways to join the conversation. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow. I'm talking with Chris Wilson. When he was 18 years old, he was sentenced to life in prison without any hope of parole. But instead of resigning himself to a life behind bars, he decided to turn his life around, came up with a blueprint that he called his master plan, and that's also the title of his memoir, The Master Plan. Let me ask you a couple of questions about your trial. First of all, you were tried as an adult.
Yes.
Did you have a record at the time, or was it just the kind of heinousness of the crime?
I had a juvenile record, you mostly did. For carrying firearms.
Right. And so you were tried as an adult. You were 17, 18 years old.
17. Yeah.
Your lawyer didn't want you to testify.
No.
Do I have that right?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. And you do say in this book that if you had testified, you would have lied.
Yeah. Because, I mean, that's part of the culture, like, growing up. Just, like, don't talk about it. Don't talk to anyone. And I didn't, I mean, I wish I would have even trusted my lawyer. I just figured, like, you know, it was like the street code. Don't tell anyone anything. You fight it. You go to trial, you know.
Keep your mouth shut anyway.
Right. Exactly.
You were sentenced to life without parole. What does that mean to an 18-year-old?
So I was sentenced to life with the possibility of parole, but you don't get parole in the state of Maryland with a life sentence. So
It's
the same thing.
The same thing.
Yeah,
but just
we're still fighting it now to this day.
Oh, that's interesting.
No one gets it.
But here you were, 18 years old.
Yeah.
thinking, I'm going to spend my life in prison.
Yeah, I felt like I was going to grow old and die there.
And you were sent to a place called Patuxent?
Yes, Patuxent, yes.
Which is, how would you describe that place?
So it's an interesting place where it's a maximum security prison, but it has a therapeutic component to it where there's therapists and you have to go to therapy, you have to go to school, but it's still a prison.
Right.
So it was an interesting place. And so I was in a particular program for people who were under 21 who committed offenses.
So maybe had more therapy, more education?
Yeah, definitely
education
at least than twice a week at least at the bare minimum. Oh. I had therapy, one-on-one and group therapy.
You describe getting really depressed, and one can certainly understand that, but also feeling as if, your father died while all this was going on.
Yeah, my father got killed while awaiting trial for like no reason. It was ridiculous.
Someone that broke into his house, right?
Yeah, someone was in the house. They killed him, and his mom was there. She had to watch him die on the kitchen floor. And it was on the news when I was in jail. And like everyone in the day room saw it, and they was like, "That's Chris' family," and I didn't see it, so I came out my cell. Everyone was just like staring at me.
Oh,
so it was strange.
Right. And you were close with your dad, right? I mean, I know you were super close with your mom.
Yeah, I got close with him right before I got arrested because he wasn't in my life most of the time, mm-hmm. and I was spiraling downhill like through depression. So I think my mom was just trying to get him like to reach me. But, you know, when he tried to get in my life, I was like, where you been all this time?
Yeah. You were
can't
angry
just,
at him.
Yeah, you just can't pop up now. You never. Where were you at when I needed you?
Yeah. You, I mean, it seems like you really lost contact with your family and spiraled into what seems like really a pretty severe depression.
Yeah. When I got sentenced, I mean, my mom even told me, I mean, I write about this. She was just like, no, you got life. So what's the point of even coming to see you or whatever? Like, you never coming home. And they stopped accepting my calls. Right. So
these were collect calls, obviously.
Yeah, collect calls, yeah.
So it was just you and yourself, right?
Yeah.
And that's where this master plan came from. How did that work? I mean, one can understand, one in certain ways, you almost can't understand how something right. like that came out of such a dark place.
I think it actually started with my mom when I was young. And my mom, like, I was always around her, but she would always instill into me, like, that I was, like, smart and that I can do whatever. Like, she was like, you can be successful, but you just got to, like, work hard. I always knew that I had, like, a good heart. And here I was, like, 18 at the time, like, in prison, staring out the window. And I was depressed, smoking weed every day in prison. And I just was like, I can't be remembered as a person that took someone's life. Like, this isn't, like, my legacy. And I'm stubborn, and it's like I refuse to accept that I was going to die in prison. So I locked myself in my cell, I think, for like 3 days. And I just started like scribbling. I was like, all right, I got to think about the person that I want to become. I also want to be free. So if all these things are going to happen, let me work backwards and figure out what I need to do in here to be successful, like when I get out. And people are like, you're crazy. You're never getting out.
Was it you know, one of those moments when you just say I'm gonna do this thing, or had it been kind of working on you, this idea of a master plan?
It was a moment.
It was
like 3 days.
Moment.
I just sat down. I was like, I'm doing this, and even if it didn't work, I said people are gonna remember me as the guy that was in prison, that like studied, that mentor, and just was like a good person, and I'll grow old and die in prison that way. But I was like, that's, you know, I'm getting out, but.
Well, you've had several master plans. This is
yeah.
one which I'd love to have you read, and this is December from 1997, so
yeah.
a little more than 20 years ago.
Yeah, so read this one?
Oh, yeah,
so, okay.
yeah.
So I have,
that's okay.
Stop calling home every day. Forget about my fake friends. Get my high school diploma. Work out 6 days a week. Gain 30 pounds of muscle. Attend weekly therapy and resolve my issues. Identify my faults that led me to prison. Always seek advice. Remain a lifelong learner. No gambling. No horseplay in public. No sex jokes. Always dress neat. Mind my own business. Learn how to speak real English. No junk food. Graduate from Carpentry Vocational Shop. Pay my brother back. Start my own business. Travel the world. Get an apartment in a nice neighborhood. Get a black Corvette convertible. Get a pair of cool Prada gloves to wear in the convertible. Get a cool leather jacket. Go skydiving. Party on a cigarette boat. Get a fresh pair of Prada sneakers. Join the Mile High Club. Lay out on the beach. Drive dune buggies through the desert. Party in South Beach. Go on a helicopter ride. Go to New Orleans. Go fishing. And then the last thing I had on here, meet a smart, beautiful woman that's business savvy.
So this we were both chuckling.
Yeah. I'm embarrassed by some of this stuff, but whatever.
But you were young, right? You were young, but you've been on a helicopter ride.
Yeah, I have.
So when you read this, this is young Chris Wilson. You recognize this young man?
Yeah. I thought it was important to keep the include the versions of the master plan. Obviously, like, it evolves throughout the book, but this was what I was like thinking about, and it was like things that I wanted to do and like how I wanted to reward myself. And then as I fine tuned it was like, all right, these are all things you want to do, but these are like rewards. You need to like, you got to go deeper. And so I eventually like just dove deeper into the plan, but it was a special feeling of having something that was written down, taped to my wall, that I can look at every day and like just think about.
You also had something that you called positive delusions.
Yeah. So I think that came to me when I read this book when John McCain was a prisoner during the Vietnam War at Hanoi Hilton. And it was a guy next door to him who would like tell them, hey, look, we're going home by Christmas. And they had been there for years. And they knew they wasn't going home by Christmas. But it was just like this blind hope or optimism that they would go home, and like it comforted them a little bit. And here I was in solitary confinement when I was reading this, and I had to tell myself, like, I just gotta believe it. This is the only way I can like study and get up in the morning if I really believe that I'm getting out. When everyone else was like, man, you crazy.
Yeah.
It's not happening.
And you had photos, right?
Yeah,
you had
photos,
pictures, your images that you used
to. I also got teased for this. So I would scrapbook. So I would find these magazines and like of like boats and like and beaches, and I would cut out pictures of myself and like women and stuff, and I would like paste it together and like a collage,
right.
And I would do this stuff, and like people would tease me about it, but I would look at them, and it was like, I'm gonna do this one day.
It made you feel better?
Made me feel better.
Like you had a future?
Right.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you, and again, Chris Wilson, our guest. He's written a book with Brett Witter. It's called The Master Plan, My Journey from Life in Prison to a Life of Purpose. And again, you can join us. That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me read a comment from someone who wants to remain anonymous. I've been to prison a few times. I can relate 110%. And here I am out of prison moving forward. A lot of black men have been to prison and they've given up on themselves. Just because the system failed me doesn't mean I have to give up. Anything you want to say in response?
I mean, my hat goes off to whoever wrote that. I mean, that's how you got to be. Yeah. You got to, I mean, the system, you know, we feel like it's broken, but others feel like it's doing just fine.
Mm.
And so I'm always happy when I hear that someone made it out and that's doing well. That's what we have to do.
You met you really became friends with this other inmate, Stephen Edwards, who was, I guess, or probably still is, a math genius, right?
Yeah, he's awesome.
How did you two meet?
So throughout, when I was working on the master plan, I would see him. He was on a different tier. And he would come out with stacks of computer books and like blank paper and just write code. And he did this like every day. So eventually, and I knew he had life too, and also went to prison as a juvenile. And I remember like talking to him, like, what are you doing? He's like, I'm going to teach myself computer programming, and I'm going to get out of prison, I'm going to start a software company, and I'm going to be successful. And I laughed at him. And I was like, dude, you don't even have a computer. Like, how are you going to pull this off? And he was like, it don't matter. And he was just like super optimistic. And this was at the point where I had written my master plan and I wanted to go to high school, but I didn't know how to do math. I didn't know how to do anything. And he just started tutoring me, and he had like interesting ways, like how to tutor me and stuff to push me. And he eventually like became like a brother to me.
In fact, his parents used to visit on a regular basis.
Yeah.
And there's some pictures of you and them all together. I mean, it seems like they kind of adopted you.
Yeah. They adopted me. Yeah. So it was a beautiful, a beautiful thing to happen, because I needed it. And like being alone in prison and just having someone to come visit you And they never judged me. And, like, they would just ask me, like, what you going to do when you get out? Or, like, what kind of books are you interested in? And, like, they would send me money.
These are the parents.
His parents. And, like, cards, or, like, when they would travel. And, you know, it was just a special relationship.
Well, it seems like you and Stephen, I mean, you started some businesses together in the prison.
Yeah, I mean, so we were both working on our plans, and we had, like, this, our study habits was, like, get a subscription to Wall Street Journal, Popular Science and stuff, and we would, like, look at emerging technology and then brainstorm on ideas of, like, how we were building this technology or, like, businesses that we would implement. And this was when digital cameras were just coming out, mm-hmm. and we was like, we can, like, take a picture and print it and print a couple? And I was like, this is crazy. But we was like, this is a business idea. We got something we can do in here.
And you made money.
Yeah, we made a lot of money.
You did.
It was great.
In prison.
Yeah. So it was awesome.
Now, what did the other inmates, what did they think about you and Stephen Edwards?
So, like, when we would study every day, and we argued a lot, too. So just like brothers, like, we would argue, and it's, like, over everything. And eventually, like, folks would see us, like, achieving stuff and, like, graduating, and they would come over and be like, hey, yo, you think you can, like, tutor me, or you can, like, explain what this means? And we would, like, you know, help people out and stuff. Mm-hmm. And so after a while, people would just, you know, those are the, you know, the guys that's, mm-hmm. like, studying. And, like, so they showed us a lot of love beyond the fence.
In prison, are lifers viewed differently from other people in prison?
Yeah, we're like the try to think of, like, the untouchables, or, like, the folks that's, like, it's almost like you're on death row. So people kind of just like, oh, he's a lifer, and they just like kind of
leave,
like,
you alone.
You can't leave you alone. Yeah, they don't have anything to lose, so I'm like, not bothering a person like that.
Oh, but interesting. You do write about the gangs and the police. I mean, the prison guards that are there.
Most of the prison guards and stuff were okay. They were decent. But, you know, you had a handful that was like, we're here to punish you, and we're going to make your life a living hell. And so I made sure I stayed out of their way. And then with the gangs, like, the gangs were actually pretty chill. Like, they did what they did. Don't bother them. They won't bother you. Like, they had their own structure and stuff. So I never really had a problem, like, with them. I usually, like, just got a pass. They just like, we're not messing with them. Yeah. Oh, he cool peoples.
You describe, and this is part of your therapy, where crime victims would actually come in and talk to the group.
Yeah.
And you described this experience. It was an older, like, an African-American woman came in and talked about what had happened to her daughter.
Yeah.
Horrible. Yeah. I mean, just a horrible, horrible crime. But after she left, something happened and something changed in you.
Yeah. So I'm going to be honest with you. Like, when my crime happened and all the stuff that I've been through, like, I was hardened, and I did what I did. But at that moment in that therapy and that conversation with the woman, that's when I truly felt remorse. And I think I was maybe 6 years into my sentence. That's when I felt it. And I started, like, really, like, being able to feel compassion, because this woman, like, this terrible incident that happened to her daughter, and, like, it was horrible. And she said, these people who did this to my daughter, they were monsters, like you guys. And then, you know, I was thinking, like, even when she was explaining the crime, and I was like, I could never do that to someone. And she thinks I'm like those guys. Right. And when I went back to the tier, the other guys that were in the group, they were laughing about it. And so when I write about it, I was like, maybe they are, maybe some of these guys are monsters. But I was like, I'm not like that. So I started working harder, because I wanted to prove to people that, like, I wasn't a monster.
It's a very powerful story. And you say several times in this book, you say, you know, that you were a good person.
Yeah.
I mean, you obviously did a terrible thing.
Right.
A terrible thing.
Right.
But that you believed you were a good person.
Absolutely. And the thing about it, like, I say that a lot, it's like, anybody can use words and say stuff, but so I was like, I gotta show people through my actions.
Yeah. Well, you showed this judge, Kathy Surrett.
I guess you
went saying, you know, wanted her to revisit your sentence, I guess, or?
I would write to her every year, like, a progress report of what I was working on this year. Like, feedback from my professors when I was in school, and then what I would do the following year. So I would do that every year. And so finally I had my day before the court, before the judge. And I remember the state's attorney, like, describing my crime in a vivid way. And then, you know, people in the courtroom, like, none of my family showed up, but, like, people in the courtroom were just leaning in, like, what you got to say for yourself? And I remember talking to the state's attorney and the judge explaining to her like what it felt like as a young man who loved his mom to watch her be attacked and feel helpless, or what it felt like to watch all my friends get gunned down and stray bullets and be harassed by the police every day, and people expecting me to be able to perform in school. And I just told her like I was angry. I explained like how remorseful I was. And then I explained about all the things that I accomplished in prison and stayed out of trouble, never got in any trouble. And then I talked about what I would do if she took a chance with me. Like I told her I'd go back into those neighborhoods and I'll be an example and I'll work really hard. And I just remember her just staring at me for a couple of minutes.
So letting it all sink in, right?
Letting it all sink in, like my heart's beating. It's like, this is my life in her hands right here.
And so what did she do?
And she said, she was like, you committed a horrible crime, but your accomplishments are nothing short of amazing. And so she says, I'm going to give you a second chance, but here's the deal. You can't just be a regular person and get a job and start a family and fly under the radar. She says, you wrote up this plan of all these ambitious things you want to do, places you want to go. You got to do everything. And she was like, I'm going to be watching you, and you better not disappoint me.
In fact, you served, what, 5 or 6 more years before you got out?
Yeah.
I mean, I guess just as a kind of insurance policy?
Well, the prison wasn't, like, people. This doesn't really happen in the prison system. So, like, it kind of surprised the institution. And it was like, so he's getting out now? And it was like, we can't let him get out because, like, just like everyone else, he's going to commit another crime. We're all going to lose our jobs. And so, I had to serve some more time.
Yeah, that's Chris Wilson, our guest on Radio Times, and we are talking about his master plan, something he put together in prison. Also is the title of his memoir, The Master Plan, My Journey from Life in Prison to a Life of Purpose. You can join us, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with Chris Wilson about his life. We've been talking about the time that he served in prison. He was released from prison. He lives and works in Baltimore now. He's an entrepreneur, has some businesses down there, also has been doing a lot of work related to criminal justice. Chris, let me just read what you wrote about Get Out of Prison. Prison strips you down to the essentials. The release system steals everything else. When you come out of prison in the United States, you have nothing of your own. No money beyond $50. They hand you in an envelope. No possessions except 4 outfits and a few personal items. No job. You're not allowed to contact anyone inside, so you're completely cut off from your friends and mentors. There are no therapy sessions, no training programs, no services. Maybe a few little things like a dusty, outdated job center, but no bed, no food, no shelter, and no support. The system provides you with 3 things: a criminal record, a parole office, and a bill for your freedom.
Yeah, that's how it works.
So how does it? I mean, so under those circumstances,
right?
What did you do?
So I had a lot of preparation time before I got out, and I kind of conditioned myself mentally to know, like, it's going to be very, very difficult. And so I worked towards it. And even a year or two before my release, I started a career center in prison. And so I'd done a lot of research, and I had a plan. I knew what I wanted to do, but I just knew it wasn't going to be easy.
Right.
And it just was bizarre. It's like you get out, and they obviously want you to get a job, but you got to come back in twice a week for check-ins or your analysis. And sometimes, like, they wouldn't even be there, and you just got to wait there. But what is my employer going to say? Like, I can't just leave work. And now, like, as a business owner, I don't want my people, like, leaving the site to, like, go check in. And it just was very difficult. But in all fairness, I will say that it starts out that way for a couple of months.
Mm-hmm.
But if you can navigate it, if you can jump through all those hoops, it kind of gets easier, and it goes to, like, every other month. And I actually built up a very good relationship with my parole officer. And so I was able to, like, to be okay. But, like, I saw many, many people go back for stupid stuff, a technicality, late for a check-in, or just silly stuff, and going back to prison and serving time.
Yeah. You hooked up and attended the University of Baltimore.
I mean, yes.
And it seemed like they were really important to you.
Right. And that was my plan. You know, like the number one way how anyone finds a job is through relationships. And I'm a lifelong learner. I wanted to go back to school. And so my strategy was to go to school, do really well, and build relationships with my professors and directors and stuff and people at the school. And hopefully they would know someone who could help me get a job.
Well, I'm sure some people listening to your story say, well, Chris Wilson, the system works then. Here's a guy made a terrible mistake, paid his, you know, paid for the crime. He's right. Now doing well. He's a successful businessman.
So I would have to, like, disagree with that. The system does not work. It works for some folks who want the system, like, to break us, right? But, you know, a lot of stuff that I've done, I took advantage of educational programs that were available to me in prison. And then when I didn't have those, I just self-taught and studied. But it's, the system does not work. And it was a lot of mental fortitude that I had to implement to get through all these things and to be successful. And I still have to implement these things.
Right. I mean, do you feel like, you know, there's no way to probably correctly answer this question, but how many people in prison are Chris Wilsons?
I think it's a lot of Chris Wilsons. Mm-hmm. You know, I make a note to always tell people that there's nothing like special or unique about me. I mean, even in prison, like I was just like everyone else, like serving a life sentence and like rough upbringing. But a handful of people saw stuff in me when I didn't even see it in myself. And it's still like this to this day. Like people will see stuff in me and say, I'm gonna spend some time with you. Come over to my house Sunday and I'm gonna sit down with you and I'm gonna look at your financials. I'm gonna give you some advice. Or people like will send me emails and maybe like scream at me, but it's coming from a place of love. And it was like, mm-hmm. you can do better. And my teachers were like that. And so I like to imagine a world where people see other Chris Wilsons in their surroundings and they do the same thing to them. I think like that'll make a huge difference in our country.
I mean, clearly you worked really hard. You were just determined to get out of prison and right. and make something of your life. How much of that do you think was just luck, that you got this judge, for instance, who seemed to be open to your story?
It's a mixture of everything. It's God. It's a little bit of luck. It's willpower. It's hard work. So it's that magic mm-hmm. formula right there. It's the sauce.
And your friend in prison that you were so connected to?
Yeah.
What's up with him?
It took him 20 years, but he's home too.
He's home as well.
Yeah.
So he was able to get out.
Yeah, we talk every day. He's like an angel in my life.
So what do you like as a boss?
It's a good question. I'm actually,
maybe you should ask the people who work for
you,
right?
True. I'm actually pretty tough. And there's a misconception for some folks, especially like I help a lot of people who have been in prison and they feel like, oh, you just like me. And it's like, I don't care that you went to prison. And it's like, you should be working harder, you know? And it's like, you know, you're not going to be talking on your phone. You're going to keep your pants pulled up. You're going to show up on time. You know, I'm always telling my people, I think I write about it in one part of the book. And it's like, people say that we're lazy or that we can't, you know, we can't get the job done. Let's prove them all wrong. And so, but I will say, you know, I'm tough, but I'm also sometimes like a social worker. Like right. I understand that stuff is going on at the house. Or like if like one of my people, like their child is sick, like we allocate resources like to help them out. You need Pedialyte or whatever. Let's run to the store. Let's get it. And then we're going to get back to work. And so.
Do you think you're the first person in their life to really to sort of hold them to those standards?
Sometimes.
And expectations?
Sometimes that's the case. And that's what I really love about the work is showing my men and women that good work ethic and just like and showing them that they can have more in life. And it's rare that we have people in our life that look like us, that come from where we come from, that's been successful, that's also like willing to help them. Like I'm never too good to go back into the hood and sit on the stoop and talk to some young guys about, you know, getting a job or starting a business. Like that's what we have to do. Like, you know, I feel like, you know, those are my people.
Let me read something else from you, Brooke. You've said, I've spent a lot of time talking with prosecutors, judges, inmates, and returning citizens, which is what I call released inmates, because that's what we are. We're not ex-convicts. We're not parolees, because those negative words make it okay for people to treat us worse than others. We are returning citizens who have served our time, paid the required price, and earned the same right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness as everyone else.
Right. Absolutely. And that's another thing. Like, labeling us is another trick that the system uses to make it difficult for us. And, like, you know, like one of the main reasons for me writing this book is it's an attempt to raise the level of consciousness of people, and not just people affected by the criminal justice system, other people who don't understand where we come from, right? And it's like, we gotta have mental fortitude and we gotta speak up for ourselves and not allow ourselves to be, like, labeled. Like, we're just like everyone else. We pay our taxes, you know, now that we can vote in the state of Maryland. Like, all these things are important and makes it more likely that we can reacclimate to society.
Your book is dedicated to your mom.
Yeah.
And sadly, she committed suicide.
Yeah.
After you were out?
Yeah, I was out, and she called me, and she was like, you know, I didn't know this was like the last time I would talk to her, but she was just giving me some things to remember, and she was just like, remember that I love you, but finish your plan, like go to work and be great and do awesome stuff in life. And she left me a letter too, and like essentially, she had been through so much that she just couldn't handle like the pain.
Yeah.
You know, she had got addicted to drugs and she lost people too in her life, and she just couldn't be here. And I mean, I understand it. I just feel guilty that I wasn't there.
Do you think that, I mean, you were there for much of her life.
Yeah.
And obviously as a young man, not able to protect her from this guy, it was
right.
Clearly intent on abusing her.
Yeah, I still struggle with that to this day. And like even in the book, I write about it, and I write in an honest way, because she did turn on me at a certain point. And for much of my life, I didn't understand. I was like, but I love you, but why would you say like mean things? Like you wish I wasn't born, right? And like as I'm older now, I understand from like her experiences and stuff she'd been through, like she was hurt. And you know, hurt people, so. Yeah.
What does your family think of this book?
I don't know. We got to see. Like,
they know it exists, though, right?
They know it exists. Yeah,
right.
Most of them. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we'll see.
A comment from David. He said, "I bought a knife when I was a student in college because I felt unsafe walking at night. Then I realized that having a weapon might make me feel more safe, but it actually put me in some unsafe situations. What does your guest think about this?"
That's a very important point. Like, if you have it on you, you're more likely to use it. But I understand like the need to feel safe. And that's the tricky thing, you know. It's tough. Like I talk to people all the time. It's like I was carrying a weapon for protection, the same reason as he was carrying that knife. Mm-hmm. But you also got to think about, you know, like where we live. This is America. Like that knife can get you shot by the police. Like it's just not worth it. We just got to figure out like a different way. I mean, the deck is stacked against us for sure, but we got to figure out a different way.
The deck is stacked against you just because...
Just a black man living in America or living in a certain neighborhood. It's like, you know, it's forces that's out there that don't want us to succeed.
You write, talking about prison, but also the neighborhood, staying quiet isn't about protecting bad people or sticking with our own. It's self-preservation. It's the only way to get out. If you don't understand that, then you don't understand our world.
Yeah. I mean, that's a very complicated thing, like to try to explain, and especially like in prison, like there was stuff that happened around me that, you know, as a person was like this is wrong, but I want to survive, like I want to get through. This has nothing to do with me, but like this person is being like attacked or like hurt, and I made decisions in prison, and sometimes in the community, it's just like we gotta look out for our family, our own self-interest. It's more tricky now, like, you know, as you know, a civilian.
Sure.
But like it's complicated, and it's like the police not helping us. We got stuff in the neighborhood going on. It's like we want to live.
You have a son.
Yeah.
How old is Darius?
Derico.
Derico, sorry about
that.
Yeah.
So he's 23.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So he's you know, going through some stuff. I write about him.
You do.
In the book, it's real complicated. It's like here I am helping all these people, and you know, my son gets shot.
He was shot
not too long ago, and he called me. Like he called his girlfriend when he got shot, and he was screaming, and she called me, and like it was just a horrible experience. And then he got overprescribed opioids, just like my mom, and became addicted to them.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Yeah, so he's battling that now. Mm-hmm.
Does he live in Baltimore?
He's in Baltimore.
Right. Let me get Quinn. I actually quoted from Quinn earlier in the hour. We were afraid that his phone line wasn't going to be so good, but he's with us, and he's calling us from Wildwood. And Quinn, I read your comment, and I'm just curious what you have to say to our guest, Chris Wilson.
How you doing? I just wanted to say I can relate 110% all the way with everything he's saying. I've been to prison. I'm a young black man. I just turned 37 yesterday. Mm-hmm. I still consider myself young. But with that being said, I've been to prison twice, been to the county jail multiple times, and more times than none, it was for a violation of probation for simple possession of marijuana. And my last time I went to prison, it was for a fraud while working at Verizon, and I was just trying to be a great representative. Anyway, to make a long story short, I feel like the system is designed just to set us up. You know what I mean? Like, I was doing everything in my power to do everything right, and if someone else was to do these same exact things, it would be a slap on the wrist, but here I go.
Yeah.
And again, to get past all that, I've been to prison multiple times. I've been to the county jail multiple times, been in all types of programs, but I did not give up. I am still pursuing a better life for myself. I would like to consider myself an entrepreneur, but I think to be considered an entrepreneur, you got to be making money. But I'm a barber. I'm a photographer. I do videography. I got my CDL license. And again, all these things I was able to obtain my license, CDL license, through the state while I was incarcerated. But I feel like it was just a waste of time.
Well, you know what,
Quinn? Because when I came home.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I'm sorry to do that. Only just I'm looking at the clock. And I do want no problem. And I just want to give Chris Wilson a chance to respond to you directly, Quinn.
So first, I would like to say happy birthday. and you are an entrepreneur. Like all those skill sets, you are an entrepreneur and you are successful. And I always tell people this, like, you made it out. You're out now. You made it out. But the system is stacked against us, right? And so what you got to do, what we all have to do, is we got to remain vigilant and we got to be conscious that we know, like, the system's after us. And so we got to self-check and we just got to be mindful.
Mm. Have you heard a lot from people who have, and Quinn, thanks for the call, who have served time in prison and can relate to
all
your
the time.
Story?
Yeah, all the time. And I go back into the prisons. People call me every day, collect. Yeah, all the time.
Right. So if you could figure out, if we could figure out how to reform our criminal justice system, and I mean, there were some Supreme Court rulings about no more, you know, for juveniles who were lifers,
right.
You know, that their cases get to be reheard. What advice do you have?
It's interesting, right? I'm an optimist, but the system has always been there. If you look at, like, slavery and Jim Crow, like, it never really goes away. It just metamorphosizes itself into something else, right? And so I'm not saying I have a solution, like, to change the system. I think it's going to take a long time, baby steps. But what I do say is people that's being impacted by it, we got to raise our level of consciousness so that it doesn't sweep us up. You know, we got to be like, you know, you jump in somebody's car, it's like, is it guns in here? What's going on? We got to be mindful. You get pulled over, you got to put that wallet and license and registration right on the dashboard, hands where you can see them. We just got to move differently because we're the targets.
Right. Well, it's been such a pleasure, Chris Wilson. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us today on Radio Times. And again, Chris Wilson, our guest, his book is called The Master Plan, My Journey from Life in Prison to a Life of Purpose. I should add, he's owner and founder of the Barclay Investment Corporation. That's in Baltimore. Also, the House of Da Vinci. That's a high-end furniture restoration and design company. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show. Find us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bill Durchon, Aarons, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us.